The title of my talk is Quench Dynamics in Interacting in Disordered Field Theories in One Dimension. And everything I'll talk about is online in some form or the other. And my collaborators on this work are Marco Tavora, who's my graduate student at New York University, Achim Roche, who's at University of Cologne, who I was visiting during my sabbatical, and Marco Skiro, who's at Columbia University. So let me first define a quantum quench, even though everybody here knows what it is. So it's one of the simplest ways to drive a system out of equilibrium. Essentially, you imagine preparing a many-particle state in the ground state of some initial Hamiltonian HI, which I call this initial wave function, I call it phi HI. And imagine changing the coupling parameter of the Hamiltonian rapidly from one value to another so that you have a new final Hamiltonian, which is such that the initial wave function is no longer an exact eigenstate and it acquires non-trivial time evolution. So this is what many people in this conference have been talking about. And I'll just remind you what are some of the interesting questions you can ask here. So one obvious question is to ask is what happens at long times? So does the system thermalize? Usually in a course in statistical mechanics, you feel that if the system is complicated enough and the particles are strongly interacting with each other, then in StatMech, we have been told that maybe within a few collisions, the particles will lose memory of the initial conditions and the system will look thermal. But the question is, how does this really happen? If so, on what timescales, et cetera? The second kind of question that people have been trying to address is when you're doing quench dynamics, you're always talking about time evolution in a closed quantum system, so unitary time evolution. And we know that if we start with an initial state, which is a pure state, then the density matrix of this pure state has this property that trace of rho square is 1. But we know that the density matrix of a thermal state is trace of rho thermal square less than 1. And since trace of rho square is preserved under unitary time evolution, there's no way you can go from this point to this point. So it's clear that the density matrix of the full system will never appear thermal. It will be only some reduced density matrix of the system which will look thermal. And so defining the reduced density matrix, and then what probably follows from this is that not all observables will thermalize in the same way. Maybe local observables will thermalize on much faster timescales, whereas more and more non-local observables will retain memory of its initial conditions. So this is also an important and puzzling question, really understanding thermalization in the context of a closed quantum system. Thirdly, there are many experiments and numerics and also recently some analytical studies which show that many quenches in many interacting systems, even though they're not integrable, show complicated dynamics in the sense that they never seem to thermalize rapidly, but they seem to get trapped in some kind of metastable non-equilibrium state, which have been called pre-thermal states. So understanding the emergence of these pre-thermal states, under what conditions they arise, what is their stability, is an interesting question. And finally, a question which is very intriguing is understanding quench dynamics near critical points. So we all know in, again, courses in thermodynamics that if you're looking at a system which is near a quantum critical point or a classical critical point, it shows universal behavior. But let's say I disturb such a system in a time-dependent manner, like in a quench, will the time evolution show some kind of universal properties? So these are like some of the questions which at least I find very interesting. And hopefully in this talk, I'll try to touch upon each of these. Now, these are just some generic slides which just say why people study quenches. Obviously, one of them has to do with experiments in cold atomic gases, the fact that you can realize all kinds of condensed matter Hamiltonians in very ideal settings. And secondly, I think one shouldn't forget that even in ordinary solid state systems, you now have the possibility of studying non-trivial quantum time evolution using ultra-fast pump probe methods. You can really study this so-called short time in this pre-thermal regime that I was mentioning. And here there are signatures from various groups, for example, Andrea Cavallo's groups at Hamburg, where they've shown that really perturbing the system very strongly in time and choosing the perturbation very carefully, you can stabilize all kinds of new metastable states. So what my talk is going to be about this. So what this is basically the model I'll study. I'll always study the problem in one dimension because there are all kinds of analytical tools available in 1D. I'll always consider a case where initially the system is in the ground state of a harmonic theory. So in particular, I'll study the Luttinger model. Initially, I'll consider bosons, which are described by the ground state of this the Lattinger model with some with an interaction parameter k, and then I'll ask what happens when I suddenly switch on a perturbation v, where the property of this perturbation is that it's going to be the leading irrelevant perturbation or the or a marginal perturbation, and I will consider two kinds of quenches. One would be where this perturbation corresponds to switching on a commensurate periodic potential. And so I'll study the dynamics in the vicinity of the superfluid Mott quantum critical point. As you know, when you have this Luttinger liquid with the cosine potential, depending on the parameters k and the strength of the periodic potential, you could go into a Mott insulating phase. So I will study the dynamics arbitrary close to the Mott insulating critical point coming from the superfluid side, where this perturbation is either irrelevant or it's marginally irrelevant. And then the second quench I'll consider is one where this perturbation V corresponds to switching on a disordered potential. And so here we know, or at least there are some old work, for example, by Giamarchi and Schulz, which have shown that you have a superfluid Bose-Glass quantum critical point. And I'll study the dynamics coming from the superfluid side, but arbitrarily close to the bosonic quantum critical point. And I don't think I'll have time for this, but you can also imagine switching on a local impurity potential, which is the so-called Kane-Fisher problem, and also ask similar questions. And this last work is with Marcus Quiro. So,
you're starting in the ground state of the
Luttinger. I'm always starting at the ground state of the Luttinger liquid. Yes. Now, before I start doing quenches, just to put the notation right, let me just remind you about some simple properties of the ground state of the Luttinger model. So remember that there is only one dimensionless variable that describes the ground state properties, is the interaction parameter k. In my language, k going to infinity is free bosons. K equal to 1 is hardcore bosons or free fermions. And k less than 1 is when the bosons are interacting via long-range interactions. And the two most relevant correlators to look at are, one is the density-density correlator, which measures how susceptible the system is to forming a charge density wave. And the other is a boson propagator, which measures the dual property, which is how susceptible the system is to forming a superfluid. And the density-density correlator in the ground state of this Hamiltonian shows power law decays, because in one dimension, quantum fluctuations prevent true long-range order. And this power law is determined by the Luttinger parameter k, whereas the boson propagator, which measures the superfluidity in the system, also shows power laws. But the power laws are now governed by the dual exponent, so it goes as 1 over k. And these are, so all my results will be in the context of these two correlation functions. So just a reminder that they're power laws, and they have this kind of a dual structure in the ground state of the theory. So now, before I turn on the nonlinearity, I again want to remind you of some very old results. I would say old in the sense since 2006, of doing a quench within the Luttinger model. So again, it's an exactly solvable problem, and it's kind of nice to see what kind of results you get from this simple quench. So imagine that I start with a Luttinger model with interaction parameter k0, and then I suddenly switch on the Luttinger parameter from k0 to k and ask, how does the system evolve in time? So phi of hi is the ground state of the Luttinger model with interaction parameter k0. Hf is the Luttinger model with interaction parameter k. And then I look at some observable a and ask what happens at very long times after the quench. So this is, again, so what do we find? So again, I will put the present the results in the context of these two correlators, the density-density correlator, which tells you how likely the system is to forming a charge density wave, and the boson propagator, which tells you how likely the system is to form a superfluid. And essentially what you find is that both these correlators at very long times after the quench surprisingly still decay as power laws. So remember, it was a power law even in the ground state of the Luttinger model, but it turns out that even when you have violently perturbed the system by changing the coupling parameter suddenly, it still continues to be a power law, but the exponent that determines the power law is not the same as the ground state of the final theory. So I've written down the exponents of this new correlators, the density-density and the boson correlator. They retain memory of the quench, so they depend both on the initial Luttinger parameter as well as the final Luttinger parameter. And if I had no quench, I would have recovered these familiar exponents for the, coefficient for the decay of the density correlator, and this is for the superfluid order parameter. The most general statement you can make about these new exponents is that they're always larger than the exponents in the ground state of the final Hamiltonian, so the system is more disordered. So it is, even though it's power law, the power laws decay much faster. And why it comes out to be a power law is, I think, just the special property of this kind of quench. If I had done a slightly more complicated quench, it could have been an exponential decay. But this particular interaction quench still gives you power laws, but it's a different exponent, and the system is just more disordered, both from the point of view of forming a superfluid as well as a charge density wave, because everything decays faster. And this memory dependence, so remember that if the system had...
Sorry, do you still have that?
No, moreover, the duality is also lost. So this goes as k1 over k, but this is some complicated combination, so the duality is lost. So now, so remember that this system has no reason to thermalize, because I'm only talking about non-interacting bosons. If the system had thermalized, I would have found instead that the correlators decayed exponentially fast with position, with the quantity would determine the exponent. Exponential decay being the temperature, which comes from energy conservation, right? But here you don't see that. So a simple way to see why you recover this kind of non-equilibrium steady state is to remember that when I'm doing this quench, I've prepared the initial state to be the ground state of some harmonic bosons. Let me call it the A bosons. And then the quench involves time evolving the system with respect to the B bosons, where the A and B bosons are related by some Bogoliubov rotation, where the Bogoliubov angle depends on this K0 and K parameter. And since my initial state is a ground state of the A dagger A bosons, this relation between them immediately tells you that the initial state is a highly excited state of the B dagger B bosons. And these are also conserved during the dynamics. So there's no way that you can recover true thermal equilibrium, because each of these bosonic modes are occupied in some very non-trivial way determined by the details of the quench. And so there was a proposal by Marcus Rigol and collaborators, which said that you don't have to do all this work to study the time evolution. You can guess the long time behavior by simply taking the average with respect to a GGE, a generalized Gibbs ensemble, which constrains the value of these B dagger B variables by the initial state expectation value. And then we heard many talks in this conference which showed that maybe it doesn't work so well when you have more complicated interacting field theories. But for these simple harmonic theories, it seems to be working most of the time. Okay, before I go again to the nonlinear theory, there's another interesting thing that you can see when you look at the two-point function, not at infinite time, but some finite time after the quench. So now I'll look at, say, the density-density correlated unequal position, but some time t after the quench, Tm. In my previous results, I put Tm to infinity, but let's now keep Tm finite. Then you see, again, some very generic results discussed, again, by Fabian, for example, at this conference. You see what is known as the horizon effect. So what I've shown here on the x-axis is r, which is the separation between the two points, two correlators. And on the y-axis, I have the time after the quench. Actually, I should have written 2t. And so when the two points are outside, this line r is the horizon. And so when the two points are outside the light cone, that means their distance of separation is very large as compared to the time after the quench. Then not surprisingly, the correlator is more or less that of the determined that by the initial wave function. So it decays as 1 over r to the 2k0, where k0 is the initial Luttinger parameter. But there is some time-dependent corrections. And there's a simple physical way to understand this time-dependent corrections. If you try to write these correlators in terms of the original fermions of the interacting theory, so you can think of these time-dependent corrections as the formation of the new quasi-particles of the theory. So this is exactly how Kazalia presented his results in 2006. Basically, you know, your Luttinger model is some kind of bosonic version of an interacting fermionic theory. And so if I do a quench from non-interacting fermions to interacting fermions, it takes some time for the fermions to get dressed and acquire some quasi-particle weight. So the short time behavior here, which is outside the light cone, given by this time-dependent free factor, should be thought of as the formation of these quasi-particles in the theory. And then from outside the light cone to inside the light cone, you see a gradual change in the behavior of the correlation function, where inside the light cone, the full effect of the quench has set in, and you end up getting time-independent results with some new with the new exponents I was discussing in the previous transparency. And this crossover happens right on the light cone, where how wide this crossover is depends on your underlying lattice cutoff and things like that. So this is a really general result. And so the question is how all this changes when I put in some kind of nonlinearity in the problem. So the first kind of nonlinearity I'll consider is one where I have switched on my quench. I'll keep things a little simple. I will not change the Luttinger parameter. I will keep the Luttinger parameter fixed, but I'll suddenly switch on a periodic potential. So then just to remind you that a Luttinger liquid in a periodic potential shows in 1D is described by the BKT phase diagram, where on the x-axis here I have a Luttinger parameter k, and y-axis I have strength of the periodic potential. And there is some critical point there's a critical line separating the phase where the periodic potential is irrelevant from the phase where the periodic potential is relevant. And this critical line ends at Luttinger parameter k equal to 2. And I will look at the dynamics here on the superfluid side where this perturbation at RG is irrelevant. So the idea is to kind of do some kind of controlled perturbation theory. So what I'll do is I'll write down some kind of, my initial Hamiltonian is this harmonic theory, final Hamiltonian is this one. Today in the results, I'll keep k0 equal to k fixed and only switch on this suddenly this common suited periodic potential. And I will write it as some kind of a Keldysh path integral. So, it has a harmonic part, which describes only the free bosons. And it has the interacting part. And I will in particular look at a two-point correlation, the time evolution of the same two-point correlation function that I discussed in the previous slide. In other words, if my cosine potential is cosine gamma phi, I look at the time evolution of the equal time but unequal position correlation function. This correlation function, you can show is the bosonized version of this unequal position but equal time spin-spin correlation function. So you can write this correlation function also as some kind of Keldysh path integral. And I will develop a RG procedure where even though this is a time-dependent problem, the idea is that I can still I can still integrate out modes that are oscillating very rapidly in position. So I will, lambda is my cutoff in momentum space. And what I'll do is I'll gradually integrate out momentum space modes that lie within a shell from lambda minus d lambda to lambda, then rescale position, also rescale time, and then absorb the corrections into the rescaling of various coupling parameters in the problem. And I can do this even for a two-point correlation function that I just defined in the previous slide transparently. So what I'll do in the process is develop some kind of a Kalanzi-Manzig equation which will relate the correlation function within the cutoff lambda with the correlation function in the reduced cutoff by some differential equation. And you can see that this has all the ingredients of a Kalanzi-Manzig equation. So let me show you step by step how this actually works. So again, I will look here at this correlation function, unequal position equal times. I will consider this quench where I'm arbitrarily close to the critical line. So initially I have some fixed Luttinger parameter and then I suddenly switch on non-zero G. When I don't have the G, then the correlators just decay as a power law. It just goes as 1 over R to the 1 plus delta over 2, where delta is the deviation from this critical point from the Mott insulating phase. Now, if I do leading order perturbation theory in the cosine term, I'll get results that obviously depend upon the time after the quench, right? Because you have the horizon effect order by order in perturbation theory. So the leading order correction is order g. And then when the time after the quench 2t is very short as compared to the position, I get logarithmic corrections which get cut off by the time. Then when I do, let's look at the last line. Let's say I have times which are very large as compared to the separation between the two points, I get a steady state result, log of r times lambda. So it's the shorter scale which is cutting off the logs. But most interestingly, when you're right on the light cone when 2t is equal to r, you get a log which gets cut off by time, of course, but the prefactor is new. It's completely different. It's enhanced. So, okay, if you think about it, this is not surprising. What this is saying is something you would have seen even if you had done the Luttinger interaction quench in the Luttinger model. What you find is some behavior outside the light cone, which is primarily determined by the initial state, another behavior inside the light cone, but there's always an enhancement on the light cone. And the physical reason for this enhancement on the light cone is that when you do a quench, you create this non-equilibrium population of particles that are moving in the left and right direction. And on the light cone, 2t equal to r is when these quasi-particles, which are highly entangled, initially reach the two points two operators at the same time. So you always see this enhancement. And when you do this special quench, which goes arbitrary close to the critical line, this enhancement shows up as an enhanced logarithmic correction. But now all of you who have done RG will know that I have actually set up a way to do RG in this time-dependent problem. So my RG philosophy is going to be a way to resum these logarithms. And so I will now, I've only shown you what happens to order G. I also have to go to order G square in order to correctly capture this BKT critical point. At order G square, what happens is that you begin to renormalize the coupling parameters G and delta themselves, like you do in equilibrium. So let me show you. So here is the next step. So the RG can follow as follows, happens as follows. I now reduce the cutoff lambda from lambda to lamda minus d lambda, and then I reabsorb all the changes to the coupling parameters in such a way that the physical correlator remains unchanged. That's the philosophy in the derivation of even the Kalanzi-Munsig equation in equilibrium, and I'm doing exactly the same thing out of equilibrium. And so I get this kind of differential equation for R. Let me explain. The first thing is something you're familiar even in equilibrium is the beta function, which I have to, in this problem, I have to go to order G square, and it tells you how various coupling parameters evolve. And the second term is basically the animalist dimension of the correlation function R, which I could have read off from these slides, right? Because you can see that these logarithmic corrections can be thought of as slight changes to the exponent that determines the decay of this correlation function. And so now what happens in this problem is that this animalist dimension depends on the time after the quench. Because if you're at times very large, if you're at time very short after the quench, then is the animalist dimension of more or less the free theory. But there is a change in the animalist dimension when you're right on the critical point, which I was telling you about, because of this enhanced factor of 3/2. And taking that into account, you can just integrate these RG equations. So this is the solution. And you can think of it in exactly the way you think of it in equilibrium, that you want the correlator at large distances and large times. And what the RG allows you to do is relate the correlation function at large distances and large times with the correlation at short distances at short times and renormalize couplings, where this coupling is so weak at these large distances, because I'm on the irrelevant side, that you can just determine it within perturbation theory. So I have a relation between something that required summing up all terms in perturbation theory with some term which I can just determine to order zero in the coupling parameters. So
the dimension of the perturbing the quench operator, the quench cosine, is never pushed relevant.
Here I'm not going to talk about the relevant case. I'm going to go always closely. Yes.
But I mean, it has an anomalous dimension, which makes it irrelevant or marginally.
Or marginally irrelevant. Yes.
I mean, that doesn't get renormalized. So it becomes.
I'm always in the case where even as it gets renormalized, it always stays at most marginal. Yeah. So initially, even though it can grow, but it never, yes. Now before I give you the results, I should also mention that there is another thing that is a little bit tricky when you do RG out of equilibrium. So many of the things I was mentioning sounds a lot like equilibrium. I wrote down this Kalman-Simons equation. There's an animal scaling dimension. Yes, it depends on time. And it's interesting the way it depends on time. But there are other things that are kind of a little bit nasty. And that comes from the fact that when you're out of equilibrium, this cosine term can cause inelastic scattering between particles, and it can give rise to dissipative effects. And that also shows up in the RG. And it shows up as follows in my formalism, that you know, if I write down the action, this is the familiar action for a Luttinger model, these del R squared minus del T2 squared terms. But when I integrate out these high energy modes, you also end up generating terms that have the physical meaning of dissipation and noise. And so you know that they should be there, but and they make the make life complicated. But the way I deal with this problem is in this way. You have a question?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. You're right. So my argument is that the non-universal parts don't show up immediately because the non-universal physics. So that's why eventually. So that's why that's my next slide. I'll explain to you how I actually think of this problem during the time evolution. So my what I'm going to argue is that when you quench arbitrarily close to the critical line, there's really a separation of time scales, and there's an intermediate time regime where the results maintain a universal result. And then there's a transition to this thermal regime, which is completely non-universal, and you see a thermalization, essentially inelastic scattering, where the scattering rates depend on the underlying cutoff and things like that.
And is it true that if I turned on a relevant perturbation, then I would suppress these non-universal contributions from the cutoff efficiently?
I'm not sure what happens when you switch on. I mean, I can wave my hands around today for the disordered problem and say a little bit about what happens there. But it's not immediately obvious that it'll immediately become universal again or anything of that sort. I think maybe you have to be very, very relevant for it to be, again, universal and not the usual critical line, which demarcates relevance from irrelevance in equilibrium is not going to work. Yeah. So if I go very deep into the relevant phase, then maybe it's possible, but I don't know about it because I'm always kind of attacking the problem from the other right. Anyway, so yeah, so there are these nasty things which make things non-universal. But then my what I'm going to argue is that during the time evolution, as long as the time is less than the generated dissipation rate, which is the inelastic scattering rate, which you can also think of as determined from some kind of Fermi-Golden rule, I can neglect these so-called noise and dissipation terms that are generated in the action. I have this really nice Kalman-Simons equation and get the usual kind of universal behavior that you get in equilibrium. But then times greater than this, I have to take them into account. And so if I have time today, I will try to tell you how I take even the long time regime into account. But first, I'll tell you what happens in this universal pre-thermal regime, where I have neglected these noise and dissipation terms. And also, I should mention that the width of this regime, you know, it's just a Fermi-Golden rule, so you can show that it goes as square of the strength of the nonlinearity that's switched on, multiplied by the energy square, energy being energy that is injected into the system due to a quench.
Energy density?
Energy density, yes.
Doesn't that diverge actually?
Energy density, E over L, it doesn't diverge. No. Yeah. In fact, if I did an interaction quench, you can show that this energy density goes as K0 minus K to the 4 or something for small quenches. Okay. Yeah, I don't think that my perturbative approaches can capture the integrability. Though I think that if I discuss with people who are really integrability experts, they tell me that if you are in the irrelevant or marginal side, they wouldn't be using the usual tools of integrability because they have to regularize the ultraviolet divergences in some way. And then when you put it on the lattice, it doesn't, yeah, it's not integrable anyway.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, the energy density in units of the underlying ultraviolet cutoff.
Oh, yeah, so it diverges with the ultraviolet.
Yeah, but that's, it doesn't worry me because I'm talking about, I'm a condensed matter physicist. There's always a finite ultraviolet cutoff. I never put lambda to infinity.
So the temperature, the effective temperature that
you
would get,
yeah,
would be very high.
Yeah, it's high in the sense that if I again scale it by the ultraviolet cutoff, it goes as g squared times the amplitude of the quench, which I can make arbitrarily small, right?
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so now I'm going to give results in the universal regime which people like, which is that times are still short as compared to the inelastic scattering rate. And so I'm going to now present the result which, where the quench goes arbitrarily close to the critical line, where you really have logarithmic corrections coming from the marginal perturbation. And so now outside the light cone, what happens is you have 1 over r of the underlying bosonic theory. But now because of the, if you like, the formation of the quasi-particles of the new theory, you get logarithmic corrections which goes the square root of log of time. Remember that this time is still large as compared to the microscopic theory. So all this result holds as long as not only r and 2t have some relative relation between them, but they each have to be large as compared to the microscopic cutoff. So this is, this time-dependent prefactor is just the formation of the quasi-particles of the new theory, which you also see when you do a quench in the Latigny model. When you go inside the light cone, which is r much less than 2t, then you begin to get square root of log r, then you get square root of log r over r. But here I would not take the results to very long times because the time has to be cut off by the inelastic scattering rate. But the most interesting thing is really on the light cone, r equal to 2t, you really have a new non-equilibrium scaling regime where this enhancement coming from these highly correlated quasi-particles gives you an enhanced logarithmic correction which goes as log of r over r. Now, what happens if I quench slightly away from the critical line? Then the logs go away and you get power laws, where these power laws are now slightly renormalized by the cosine potential, and the results are non-universal. Non-universal because it's non-universal in the Latinger liquid sense that the coefficients depend on the microscopic parameters of the Hamiltonian. So outside the light cone, you have 1 over r, but some time-dependent prefactor for the formation of the new quasi-particles which depend on all these dirty factors, delta and g, and then it crosses over to a steady state result, which again is only valid when the time is short as compared to the quench. So now all this is fine, and there is some kind of control RG you can do here in this place. Now what about the long time regime? So long time regime, I'm going to capture it by constructing a kinetic equation. And, but before I go to the long-time regime, I actually want to go back and talk. I want to talk about the universal pre-thermal regime, the analog of this, for a slightly different kind of quench, and one where instead of switching on a commensurate periodic potential, I switch on a disordered potential. Okay, so let me switch gears. How much time do I have left? Okay. So now let's consider, again, a quench where I have initially a Luttinger model. And instead of switching on a commensurate periodic potential, I switch on a disordered periodic potential. And again, we know that there are two possible phases here. One where this disorder is a completely irrelevant perturbation. The system continues to be a superfluid. And there's one where it actually is a relevant perturbation and the ground state is a Bose glass. And this problem was studied by, for example, Giamacchi and Schulz in 1987. And it turns out that you also have a BKT phase diagram separating the superfluid from the Mott phase, where now the critical point separating the two in the limit of arbitrarily weak disorder is k equal to 3/2. So in the spirit of the first half of my talk, I'll again consider a situation where I've prepared the bosons initially in a superfluid state, and then I suddenly switch on a disordered potential. And I'll go arbitrarily close to this critical line. And so there's, let me just tell you, there's no MBL in anything I'll talk about today. And it's kind of complementary to what people have already discussed in this, in the in other talks. So my initial Hamiltonian, again, is just the Luttinger model. And the final Hamiltonian is the Luttinger model plus a disorder potential, where the disorder potential has two parts to it. One is forward scattering. In this bosonic language, I have forward scattering interactions, and then I have a backward scattering interaction. And I'm going to assume quench disorder like people usually do, where the disorder average of these things, these are random variables with strength df for the forward scattering interaction and db for the backward scattering interaction. And I'll study the time evolution of the same two correlation functions I discussed. One is the density-density correlator, e to the twice I phi at r, e to the minus twice I phi at position 0. And the other is the boson propagator, e to the I theta at r, e to the minus I. So unequal position, but equal times after the quench. And again, I can write everything as a Keldysh path integral. And now on top of that, I'm also going to do disorder averaging. And so another technical point is that once you have put everything on Keldysh, doing disorder averaging comes almost for free. It's very easy to do it. You don't have to put replicas. And I guess in an experiment, what disorder averaging would mean is that in an experiment like an Alain Aspect experiment or the experiment in Florence, you know, you have one disorder realization, and you study the time evolution for that disorder realization, but you repeat the experiment many, many times where the disorder is slightly different. So that's how you would do disorder averaging. So what do we get? So the surprising thing here is that when you quench, then even the forward scattering disorder ends up being very important. So let me again do a very simple problem. Let's forget about the backward scattering part. Let's say that my disorder suddenly only involves switching on this forward scattering part. Now, you will notice right away that I can rewrite this interacting theory, harmonic theory in terms of shifted fields, phi twiddle, which are related to the original phi by this simple shift. And then HF again becomes quadratic. And again, it can be written in terms of some new quasi-particles. But in equilibrium, therefore, you would argue that the forward scattering doesn't do anything. But this is not the case here, because you want to average your quantities in terms of the ground state of the initial Hamiltonian, which was the ground state of the phi field and not the phi twiddle field. And because of this, it turns out that forward scattering does end up doing something very important to the correlators after a quench. So this is the result for the density-density correlator, and the second is the result for the boson correlator. This is without doing any disorder averaging yet. So one particular realization of the disorder. Essentially what happens is when you quench it, you create a non-equilibrium population of particles, and then these are propagating in the left and right direction, and they see a random forward scattering potential, and so they pick up random phases. And so these the correlators end up being the correlators in the ground state, which is as if there was no forward scattering term, but multiplied by these random phases. And you can see that these phases all come from left and right moving particles moving from distance r to r plus ut or r minus ut. You see all these integrals go like this. If eta was uniform, then these again don't give you anything. You just go to zero. But when eta is non-uniform, then you pick up these phases. And then if you do disorder averaging, what you find is that the forward scattering interaction produces random dephasing, and that causes these correlators to all decay exponentially in time for short times or exponentially in position for long times. And the physics is just that you have forward scattering induced dephasing, which is destroying superfluidity. So that's just the forward scattering part. And then you can ask what happens when I switch on the backward scattering part. So I can repeat some of the things that I did for the clean potential. Yes?
Can you look at probability distributions here? Like, let's see, the expanders and time. Like, how far are you from the disorder averaging? Are there rare occurrences? Like, there are rare regions in the disorder system?
Yes, you certainly can, because at least at this level, everything is harmonic. So you can look at it for any particular disorder realization and see what kind of what the correlations are looking. Yes. So because of this harmonic theory, you can do, everything's under control. So now let's ask, what does the backward scattering interaction do? So what happens is, let's again do perturbation theory, because I'm assuming to begin with that the backward scattering is weak. So if I now do the opposite thing where I have no forward scattering but only backward scattering, then what you find is, in the spirit of what we found for the clean periodic potential, where you had, say, a power law of the clean Luttinger liquid plus corrections, logarithmic corrections, if I go arbitrary close to the critical line, it turns out these logarithmic corrections, when you have no forward scattering but only backward scattering, go as log square. And this is consistent with the fact that the RG flow of DB goes as 1 over log square. So this leading correction is order 1. And so you need to resum this term using some RG method. And that's what typically you do, for example, in the papers by J.M. Archie and Schulz. That's what they do. The RG is set up to resum these logarithms. But now, if I do a quench, so that now I look at the effect of the backward scattering in the presence of a non-zero forward scattering, what happens is that this dephasing from the forward scattering interaction makes the cuts off many of these logs. So the leading correction ends up being only is no longer order 1, but subleading. And so the effect of the backward scattering, so the effect of the quench is to make the backward scattering term in some sense more irrelevant. So the k equal to 3/2 points is no longer so dangerous. And well, this may be good or bad news. It just means that you can still push perturbation theory further into the so-called phase, which is supposed to be localized in equilibrium. Anyway, so after this, I'm not going to go any further. So the point here is that in the presence of disorder, you have this pre-thermal regime. And this pre-thermal regime is completely dominated by forward scattering-induced dephasing. There's nothing universal about it, because all the correlators, unlike the clean case, decay exponentially fast by a rate which is determined by the strength of the forward scattering interaction. And then the longer time regime, what we do is we construct some kind of kinetic equation to study how the system eventually thermalizes. And how much time do I have? Okay. So let me then tell you a little bit about how we capture this long time regime. It's not surprising that when inelastic scattering is important, you should construct one way to deal with the problem is just construct a kinetic equation. That's what people have done for many years in the past. But what is missing is a kinetic equation description for an interacting field theory in 1D. And 1D things always get complicated, because what happens is that in one dimension, first of all, phase space for scattering is highly suppressed. Secondly, if you have a naive phi to the 4 interaction, and I just look at the leading order self-energy, if you like, that goes into the kinetic equation, it takes into account only two-particle scattering. And two-particle scattering cannot relax a distribution function in 1D. Because basically, unless there's something very special going on in 1D, when two particles scatter, they can only either the momenta of the two particles remain unchanged, or they just simply interchange. And that can never relax a distribution function. So that's been a real problem to construct a kinetic equation in 1D. And typically, people have taken FIFO theories and pushed it to construct, look at three-particle scattering. Nobody's done four-particle, but for example, three-particle scattering, if the model is not integrable, can give you non-trivial relaxation. Here I'll show you another way to construct a kinetic equation where I'm not doing this two-particle, three-particle, four-particle scattering, but I'm just doing a kinetic equation to leading order in the cosine term, which could be the uniform periodic potential or it could be the disordered potential. And then I'll show you that the self-energy just captures multi-particle scattering processes and it can give you relaxations, even to leading order in the cosine potential. So here is how we construct the kinetic equation. You essentially write down the Schwinger-Dyson equations. GR is the retarded Green's function. F, GK is the Keldysh function. F is the distribution function of the particles. And you can write the time evolution of the distribution function of the particles. And the main thing here is to find a way to calculate these self-energies, sigma k, sigma r, and sigma a. And this is where, you know, in 1D or 2D, 1D, if you have a very typical kind of perturbation, which is 5-4, you can think of it as two-particle or three-particle scattering. But here, we can construct these sigmas for this cosine term. And they have this form in the sense that they allow for multi-particle scattering between bosons. And you can just time evolve this. It's a little bit complicated, but after doing a leading order truncated Wigner, leading order gradient expansion, you can make the problem local in time and time evolve it numerically. And what we find is that So this is a result for the disordered problem. So I've constructed the kinetic equation for in the presence of backward scattering disorder, and I've also done disorder averaging. And this is showing how the distribution function n of q multiplied by q evolves as a function of time. So at t equal to 0, we have this almost flat line, because it turns out that the initial non-equilibrium population of these particles goes as 1 over q. So q times n of q ends a flat line. And as it evolves in time, at long times, we find that it goes to a completely thermal case, a thermal situation described by the Bose distribution function. And the inset here is, if you like, and some kind of an effective temperature, which when the system thermalizes goes to the true temperature of the system. So to see how the system is thermalizing, sometimes it's just much easier, instead of looking at how the full distribution function is evolving in time, it's just good enough to look at how the intercept is evolving in time. And this is a plot of the intercept as a function of time. It starts off with some value which depends on the details of the quench, and then it evolves to the true temperature determined by energy conservation. So one of the things to take home is that we always find that the thermalization time increases. Sorry, system relaxes very fast as you go closer and closer to the critical point. So this might be a little bit of a surprise initially, because you always hear about critical speeding up, et cetera. Critical slowing down. But the reason why this is happening is that as you go closer to the critical point, the nonlinearity, which is driving the transition, is also responsible for creating inelastic scattering. So in the first case, it was the uniform cosine potential. And in the second case, it was the disordered backscattering potential. And due to this reason, what you find is that the system relaxes the fastest near the critical point. And interestingly, this is also seen in numerics. So there are numerical simulations and also experiments that find that if you do a quench near the Mott superfluid Mott transition, the relaxation time increases near the superfluid Mott critical point. And there are also some experiments on spin ice compounds that I learned about when I was at University of Cologne. Now, specifically for the disordered problem, one can show that this relaxation rate extracted from the long time behavior of the distribution function. In general, the time evolution is complicated. There's no single time scale which tells you, there's no single relaxation rate that characterizes the time evolution. But from the long time tail, you can extract a relaxation rate which is found to depend as follows on the Luttinger parameter k. And T effective naught, if you like, is how hard I have quenched the system. It's related to the population of the non-equilibrium population of the bosons created by the quench. And you find this kind of functional behavior on this relaxation rate on the Luttinger parameter. So as k becomes smaller, this relaxation rate also becomes very rapid.
Is it easy to say why this doesn't work if I have a relevant cosine? Why your quantum Boltzmann?
Yeah, I can tell you why. So basically what happens is that if I have my, if I looked at my self energy, it'll acquire infrared divergences when the cosine terms, when the perturbation starts becoming relevant. Now, when I have the disordered potential, it's not so bad. It still kind of is a convergent self energy when k is less than 3/2. But it really becomes infrared divergence around k equal to 1. And that makes sense, because k equal to 1 is actually the free fermion point when you don't expect, again, any inelastic relaxation. So it breaks down at all the right points. And I mean, for the disordered potential, you can see very clearly that these rates, for example, here, the rate T effective, if I make T effective 0 and k is less than 1, it basically diverges. And you expect problems at k equal to 1, because this is the free fermion problem, a free fermion case where everything should be, if the disorder is strongly relevant, and you don't expect inelastic scattering. So, yeah. Okay, so I think with this, I'm going to just end. So what I've done is I've presented results for quenches in a system where there are both disorder and interactions. And I've shown you that there's an RG approach that can be developed that shows that the quenches, especially near a critical point, can show separation of time scales. There's a short time perturbative regime. Then there is an intermediate time pre-thermal regime where you can do some RG. And there's a long time thermal regime where you can construct a kinetic equation. And so I think the best way to deal with this problem is to realize that there are these three different regimes and use different techniques to tackle them. Then in the so-called pre-thermal regime, the results are kind of different for the clean case and the disordered case. So in the clean case, you really do see some kind of universal behavior where the exponents do not depend on microscopic parameters and you still have power laws. But in the disordered case, what happens is that the forward scattering disorder produces, you know, it just messes things up and it produces this random dephasing and everything decays exponentially with an exponent that depends on the strength of this forward scattering disorder. And then I constructed a kinetic equation, which I think is very unusual in the sense that it already has all these multiple particle scattering processes built into it, and it can very effectively capture thermalization. And using this approach, you find that the relaxation rate increases as you go closer to the critical point, and that's because as you go to the critical point, the operator that's relevant and responsible for the transition is also causing very strong inelastic scattering when the system's out of equilibrium. And this faster relaxation time is also actually borne out in experiments as well as in numerical simulations, completely different systems. Anyway, so with that, I'll stop. Well, it also depends upon how much you quench the system. So if you start with an initial state which is very far from the ground state of the critical Hamiltonian or whatever, then you will again shorten the pre-thermal regime. The length of the pre-thermal regime here I was showing you in this picture. So you have to make a small quench, in other words, even in the pre-thermal regime, even if you go to the critical point, you have to make a very weak quench. Because if you quench it too much, then this inelastic scattering rate, which is related to how much energy you've injected into the system due to the quench, will also...
But even in the weak quench case, the kinetic equation tells you that you relax very quickly. So I'm just saying that, is it this weird thing where you do a weak quench, you have a long pre-thermal plateau, but you get out from it very quickly?
Yeah, I think it's that. Yeah, you get out from it very quickly. Yeah.
Any other questions?
So in what sense do you get the kinetic equation? So you do you use some approximation to get the collision integral eventually out of the self-energies, or?
Yeah, so the Dyson equation, if you like, is highly non-local in time, and then you can just use diagrammatics to determine what the leading self-energy is. And you can also derive this kind of Dyson equation by applying some two-particle irreducible formalism. You write the 2pi action, apply Noether's theorem to it, and you can derive the stress-momentum tensor, and you can show that this kinetic equation is consistent with that stress-momentum tensor.
So basically, you take some approximation for self-energy, but then you're able to get the closed form, or at some point you just...
So the self-energy, the main approximation here is after you construct the self-energy, is still very non-local in time, so then we do the leading order gradient expansion and make it local, which is what you typically do even with kinetic equations. And you should do the same approximation on your stress momentum tensor to make sure that your conserved energies are, it's the kinetic equation is satisfying the conserved energies.
This diagram, do you sum them up to all orders?
Yeah, and it is not as scary as it looks, partly because, your very leading order diagram is just e to the I phi, e to the minus I phi, right? And so, even in a harmonic theory, you can see that it's phi 1 minus phi 2 square. And so these diagrams are just a way to Taylor expand this and show you that you have actually kept, that these have automatically all the lines between phi 1 and between the two points 1 and 2.
Yeah, I guess this very old work by Meeks in 1980 where they do perturbation in this fashion on the Sine-Gordon model. And they have to put it in an IR regulator, but eventually, when they do all the calculations, the IR regulator goes away. It doesn't affect anything. So I'm wondering.
Well, this is the
bite you here.
Well, this lambda.
When you have a relevant cosine.
When you have a relevant cosine.
Well, that's what you said. You said the IR, you ran into an IR problem when you went to a relevant cosine perturbation.
Yes. When the cosine is relevant, then some of these self-energies, not all of them, but some of them certainly have infrared divergences. Yeah. Maybe what he did, he expanded. He was careful to be very close to the critical point.
No.
He could not have gone.
Maybe.
Yeah, but I mean, it's very because you can see that this phis will decay slower and slower as you go into the relevant phase, and so at some point, if they're so decaying really very slowly, then you will run into infrared divergences.
The summation, I thought,
I don't know about that. Yeah.